The Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue is now open. Good morning, everyone. Minor piece of business here, first of all, before we get started, we have to re-adopt committee rules.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the rules as proposed.
Let me open up a work session.
And now I make that motion that we adopt the rules.
Senator Riley moves for the adoption of the revised interim Senate committee rules. Any discussion at this time? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Today we have a presentation on the treatment of C corporations and pass-through corporations, which to anyone outside of this tiny slice of the revenue universe would find uniquely boring and technical, but it represented probably the biggest challenge we faced earlier this year was we struggled on business tax and really signifies maybe the biggest split in the business community of all of the different issues that are out there. But the S Corps versus pass-throughs is a tremendously challenging issue in trying to set fair business taxes for anyone doing business in the state. So turn it over to Chris and Paul.
Mr. Chair, just as you commented, we've spent a lot of time kind of talking around this issue during the session, and it came up when you were looking at the whole general concept of business taxation. So I asked Chris to put together really probably the start of a series of kind of discussions about what are the differences in the tax treatment between the pass-through entities and the C corporations, and get a better understanding of what those differences are.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So, yeah, to that end, for the presentation, I've had gone through different versions trying to figure out where a good place to start it, and it was at one point a good bit longer and a lot more technical and really into the weeds, and it seemed like a good place to start in line with the sequence approach to kind of take a step back and start with all the business types and then leading up to an example that breaks down the pass-through taxation through C-Corp taxation. So I think some of it will be familiar. It might be review. It might fill in some gaps that we've discovered that have kind of crept in over the session as issues cropped up. So in some sense, it might be a review, hopefully a little more information, new information, or information presented in a slightly different way, as well as provoking some questions. So the starting point, I guess, would be a business entity type. So the types of entities that exist, you have sole proprietors, partnerships, S corporations, C corporations, and LLCs. And a lot of the discussion has been between businesses and corporations, and this is where some of the confusion starts to set in. So, but partnerships and S-Corps are the pass-through entities. Some places, some of the research or discussion I found out there actually throws in sole proprietors as a pass-through entity. But the discussion in this building is kept sole proprietors different. And one of the main reasons for that is there is no legal distinction between the person who is the sole proprietor and the business. They're the same entity. Whereas all of the other entities, there's a legal distinction between the business and then the people running the business. And so the theme here will be sole proprietors and then the pass-throughs, partnerships and S-Corps. So that's what's meant. And then C-Corporations. LLCs, as I've mentioned before, are creatures of the state. They don't really exist in federal law, but they do. They're a relatively new form. And when they file tax returns, they have to file one as one of the other entities. So a lot of the tax information we get on partnerships are really LLCs. Mostly LLCs file as partnerships. So that's where they kind of crop up in the data that we use. So one version of this, as I was thinking through, was really going through possibly making it an entire example where an entrepreneur chose the business type and the whole path. But I for various reasons, I stepped away from that, but I wanted to include some of the information because there are a lot of factors that go into determining whether an entrepreneur would choose which type of entity. And some of those would be, I've listed a few up here. You have the ownership today and tomorrow. basically, if somebody is starting a business, do they envision just themselves running the business for the duration of their life and then ending the business or perhaps handing it off to somebody else or having the business continue beyond their lifetime? Financing can be a factor, whether it's going to be equity finance through investors or debt finance through loans that can have tax implications. And then one of the big pieces might be equity interests. You have class of stock. Now, so basically, we're talking about corporations here. S corporations have one class of stock. C corporations can have multiple classes of stock. And then you have the number and types of shareholders. Are all of the shareholders in the business going to be people, or are they going to be other entities? Other businesses could be shareholders. And then you have an allocation of income and losses. Partnerships have much greater freedom in allocating income and losses across the partners than, say, S corporations. And then eventually there's an exit strategy. So you have if there's a known lifespan of an undertaking, if it's just a temporary thing or if it's going to be in it for the long haul with starting with a small business and then eventually perhaps even going public in the long run. And then you get back to the continuation beyond the current owners and whether or not you want the business to continue to your heirs or to sell it to other people. And then lastly, there is the tax considerations, which is going to be the focus here and ultimately with the example that ends the presentation and how that factors into the choice of the entity. And that's been a lot of the discussion now around tax reform. It really comes down to how are each of the different entities affected by any changes in the taxes, the tax base or the tax rates or the tax structure. So starting with the tax returns themselves, now the nature of a business, the information here is all from a tax return world. When we talk about, we often get questions about the number of businesses in Oregon, and that number can vary depending on the source of the information, whether we're talking about the employment department or census data. If I'm a business and I own two McDonald's, and one is in Kaiser and one is in Portland, is that two businesses or one businesses? One business, you get a distinction between the entities. So right here we have a total of, from the tax return perspective, about 428,000 businesses. And for the three groups, we have sole proprietors comprise about 65% of that. It's about 280,000. C corporations are about 7%. And that's just under 30,000. And then pass-throughs are about 120,000. And the pass-through entities themselves are pretty evenly divided between partnerships and S corporations. And so a history of the structure of the businesses, kind of a footprint of the businesses, is represented in this chart. This is data from the IRS. It's U.S. data going from 1980 to 2012. And the dark blue here are C corporations. Now, these are business receipts in the U.S. And we can see how the shares have changed over the decade since 1980. And in 1980, C corporations represented about 86% of the business receipts in the country, with the 35% being picked up, or 15% being picked up by the other kinds of entities. By the time we get to 2012, we're down to about 60% for C corps and 40% for non-C corps. And a couple of key points in here is this change right here is tied to the federal tax reform in 1986. The tax rates changed and really created a greater incentive for businesses to structure as S corps. So we saw that change there, and that's an example of how tax reform can really affect choice of a business entity. And then we get into
made it attractive to go to an S corp.
An S corp, yeah. The change in the tax rate structure between the C corps and on the personal side. So the rates on the personal side were reduced, and so businesses, it became much more attractive to become structured as an S corp. And then this darker green color right here represent partnerships. And a lot of this growth here, as we'll see in a couple slides, have been LLCs. Now, the first LLC to be established, I believe it was in 1977, it was the state of Wyoming. And so, but nothing really happened there for about 25 years until I believe it was Delaware established some kind of the gold standard in LLCs, and that was in the early 90s. And so we see this pick up here as the choice of new entities. And in all of my conversations with CPAs and other tax-related professionals, they often encourage that new businesses to be structured as an LLC. For all of those considerations that I went through a couple slides ago, the easiest structure is to start as an LLC, and then it's easier to grow from that point. And so that's where a lot of the business growth has been in recent years is LLCs. It's easy to start, it's inexpensive, and it leaves all of your options open for depending on for growth.
Senator Burchard.
I'd just like to point out that the reason a lot of people go for an LLC instead of a sole proprietorship is for a limited liability. That's the primary reason. Plus, you get the tax benefits of being taxed as just income, personal income. But it's the liability that is the primary driver.
Right. That was a key factor. The LLCs were a hybrid with the C corporate. If you go back to prior to that time, you had corporations where you had a separate entity from the owner of the business, and so all of the person's assets were protected.
Right.
Whereas the sole proprietor, as I mentioned before, there is no distinction between the person and the business. So the owner of the business can have some liability insurance, but there is that direct connection. And that's the risk. So with the LLCs, it really, really opened that up. But that also suggests, given this change over the years about a tax system, as policymakers and stakeholders consider what is the best tax system, looking at the footprint of businesses, this highlights where it's relevant to look at the different kinds of businesses and their contribution to the economy and what that taxation should look like for across businesses. Because arguably, from a theoretical standpoint, from an economic standpoint, there really shouldn't be a tax difference on the kind of business. You want to minimize, an argument can be made that you minimize the tax consequences for the business, so that shouldn't be a factor in deciding which business structure to follow. So the next couple of slides are some distribution tables for the types of entities and the sales and the income. So this chart right here takes the 427,000 tax returns with business income. And again, these are taken from the tax forms that the entities file. So you have a C corporation files its own tax form at the federal level and Oregon. And the pass-through entities, they file a tax form themselves. There's an S corporation return and a partnership return. And generally on those returns, they're kind of like information returns because the entity itself doesn't pay tax. Now, there are some exceptions on S-Corps, but the general piece is that they don't pay tax. And all of the income for the partners and the shareholders or the members, so partnerships have partners, LLCs have members, and corporations have shareholders, all of that income and loss gets attributed to those partners and shareholders, and that's where it gets taxed. These are counts of those returns that get filed. And then sole proprietors, these are generally Schedule C and Schedule F. Schedule C are non-business, are non-farm small businesses, and Schedule F are the farm businesses. So we can see that of the 278,000 sole proprietors, about 230,000 of them, or 65%, are the non-farm. We have about 17,000 LLCs. These are single-member LLCs. They're also referred to as disregarded entities. And then about 30,000 sole proprietor farms filing Schedule F. The pass-through entities, the 120,000, the 61,000 are S-Corps, and of the other 60,000 that are partnerships, two-thirds of those are LLCs. So we have 40,000 LLCs and about 17,000 partnerships that are general partnerships or foreign partnerships. There are a variety of potential partnerships. So now we jump to a similar chart and look at Oregon sales. And it's almost that same chart but flipped over. The smallest number of entities, the C Corps, has the largest share of sales. So we have $318 billion in Oregon sales, and we heard some of that number before during this discussion in the session around tax reform and the tax base. So for the 400,000 companies, we have $318 billion in economic activity, Oregon sales, and 192,000 of that, or about 60%, are for C-Corps. And then the pass-throughs represent about 35%, and sole proprietors represent about 5%. And then it's broken down accordingly, where the LLCs represent 27,000, $27 million in $27 billion, I'm sorry, in sales for the pass-through entities. One thing this chart doesn't show is the concentration, and that came out a little bit with the, in 2016. For keeping in mind that the C corps have about 30,000 corporations, the top 100 of them represent about 26% of all of these sales. So it's extremely concentrated. So the C corps, well, there are a lot of them, 30,000. It's really the top 100 or 200 where most of that largest footprint is. Of the $318 billion, the top 100 represent about $82 billion. So that's about 25% of all of the sales in the state, and the top 200 represent about a third of all the sales in the state. So that's that kind of distribution is relevant to the discussion and understanding where the economic incidence will lie for the any changes to the tax. On one other note about the sole proprietors here, about 90% of them have sales of less than $100,000. So those are really, we have a lot of them, but they're really the smallest of the small. And then moving to estimated business income, it's just under $18 billion. And here we have the corporations have 45%, and the pass-throughs 35%, and the sole proprietors have about 20%. And in comparing that to the sales, this number for the C corporations, the $8 billion, that's about 4% of their sales. For the S for the pass-through entities, their income is about 6% of their sales. And then for the sole proprietors, about 21%. Their income represents 21% of the sales. So the larger entities have more tools at their disposal, are able to better take advantage of deductions and so forth to lower their taxable income than our sole proprietors. And so getting back to the tax-based situation, the income here is the $18 billion, that's about 6% of sales in total. So depending on the tax structure that's being considered, you have a sales base, which is about 18 times the amount of income, where the income is only about 6%. So income is a $17 billion base, and the sales are about $318 billion base. And that's relevant for the discussion of tax rates and incidence, where generally to minimize economic distortion, you want a broad base and low rate. So those are the relevant things. There were information provided during the session that Paul went through to talk about how the different bases and the rates for get to raise a certain amount of money, a larger base enables a lower rate.
Senator Burchard.
Yeah, Chris, I hate to keep interrupting you, but since I've lived this my whole life, there's some things that I need to point out. You made a statement that corporations have more tools to reduce their tax liability. I just think they take advantage. They have the same tools, but I think the sole proprietors don't take advantage of it. One, they don't have the ability to hire the accountants to really get down in the weeds. And two, they simply don't know of the advantages that they can have. So I think they have the same tools, they just don't take advantage of them.
And I think that's reflected, and that was my point, between looking at the income as a share of their sales. Yeah. So putting those all on the same chart, we have here just a side-by-side comparison where you can see that in terms of number of businesses, sole proprietors are by far the largest group, but the pass-through entities, we have about four times the number of pass-through entities as we do C-Corps. But then when we get to sales, that's where the C-Corps really take the larger footprint. And again, that's very concentrated. And then the income gets to be a little bit more closer to a uniform, where 45% of the income is C-Corps, 35% are the pass-throughs, and about 20% are the income. And that pretty much mirrors the tax, because the tax we have right now is on the income, so that's going to mirror that distribution. So boiling all of this down, put in this table to show kind of an effective tax rate situation. That's the two columns here on the right, and comparing the different bases. So this is another look at the information that you had that was shared with the legislature this session, grouped by these three entities: sole props, pass-throughs, and C corporations. So we have the number of businesses, and then the sales, and then the income, and then the tax. So the 400 in total, we throw them all into one group, not to suggest that businesses are a uniform model, but in one valuable way to look at these is at an aggregate level. 427,000 businesses, $318 billion in sales, $18 billion in income, and $1.3 billion in tax. So overall, that's an effective tax rate of 7.3% of the income and 0.41% of the sales. Now, breaking that down across the three types, we see that for the sole proprietors, their effective income tax rate is 5.9%, compared to 9.1% for pass-throughs and 6.6% for C-corps. Now, this information I have here is for 2014. I didn't want to bounce around different tax years. The information that I grabbed was at different sources, and some more recent information is available, but I kept it all in 2014 just to keep it all uniform, because bouncing around different across years can get a bit dizzying. So as the committee's aware, that doesn't, these numbers for the pass-throughs do not include the pass-through preference rates. So what I did down to incorporate that was in the bottom here, I just changed the tax number. That tax reduction is about $100 million a year. As you know, we have only 1 year under our belt with 2015, and that estimate was about 70% of the expected, but we have a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that in 2016 and later, it's going to bounce back up to $100 million or so. So we're kind of in this phase-in period. It's not a statutory phase-in, but a gradual adoption of the policy. But to recognize that, I just took off $100 million, and we see that the 9.1% effective income tax rate on pass-throughs falls to 7.5%. So that's kind of the starting point we have for any tax reform discussions on the incidence of the tax across the entities. Now, if we look at the tax that's paid now versus sales, so this rate would be, well, let's keep everything neutral and just change our tax base from income to sales. What would the tax rates be to raise the same amount of revenue, setting aside all of the complications that the committee is aware of? But this gives some sense of where those rates are. For sole props, their tax on their sales is about 1.25%, or would be. And then the pass-throughs, that effective tax rate on sales is 0.5%, down to 0.43% if we incorporate the pass-through entity preference. And then for C corporations, it's about 0.27%. So that's a very high level of where these entities, the rates that they pay on their economic activity. And it's theoretical, because those vary across businesses for a lot of different reasons. But it's really just that initial point to have in the back of your mind of where the current tax revenue is from, especially if there are continued discussions of income. What's the proper base income or sales?
So, Chris, if we were to set a commercial activity tax rate at 1.25.5, just as you have them there in that last column, that would be those would be the rates, and it would be a revenue neutral proposition.
The revenue neutral would be if you went for across all business types, or just,
well, if you set it up like that one for those categories. 1.25, 0.52, and 0.27, if you somehow could magically do that.
Right, that would be the revenue neutral piece.
Yeah. But wouldn't that, of course you couldn't do that, because then everybody would change their filing status.
Right, that's the starting point for kind of a static view and understanding where we are. But those kind of thought experiments are helpful to think about. That's what it would be, and then you get to, well, how would they respond?
I guess that's what we did in this session, was kind of a thought experiment then.
No comment. Yeah, one of the challenges always, you can if we, and I believe you've mentioned this during the session, if we didn't have a tax system and it was brand new, it's much easier to design the system according to economic theory and how it would be based, you know, minimizing distortions, promoting economic growth. But, and that's a nice academic thought experiment, but that's not really reality. We are at a starting point, so it's always that change. How do we get from point A to point B? And how that discussion gets framed and understanding where we are now, and there are different perspectives for understanding where we are now, and so this is just one of many. But I think it's helpful to understand if we are talking about a commercial activities tax and if it were applied to all of these entities. Now, the discussion during the session, the sole proprietors, by and large, almost all of them were excluded because of the threshold discussions. There are a small handful of sole proprietors who had $1 million in gross receipts. It's a very small percentage. So some of them were touched if that threshold was $1 million, but then you get to $2 million and $3 million. So the committee and the legislature and the public, all of the stakeholders, had that discussion in one form or another. But if we just, that's why this is kind of a reset of, okay, where does everything land? And so that was the idea here of that the effective tax rates, the gross tax rates. And then I'm gonna conclude with another chart, an example that actually goes through some numbers that are very specific. One thing I just did want to mention here, as I was going through this and thinking about the income taxation of business income, there is kind of a merging or an overlap, if you will, of the taxation of what we call business income and investment income. And we have policies now, both at the federal level and in Oregon, that kind of start, that seem to straddle the difference here, with the distinction being, is a person's business income active income or passive income? And the examples of the policy we have at the federal level, since 2013, there has been the net investment income tax is 3.8% on net investment income above certain thresholds. And for like joint filers, it's above $250,000. So this is net investment income, and this is a federal tax that has helped fund the ACA, and it's part of the discussions now about a repeal. But this plays into some of the income that gets reported on Schedule E, some of the pass-through income. If I'm engaged in a partnership and I'm involved in the day-to-day operations of it, then that's active income. And that then for Oregon, I could take advantage of the pass-through entity, and then that's the policy that's been in place since 2015. On the other hand, if I'm a partner in a business and I just invested, gave my brother $50,000 to invest in a business, and I have nothing to do with the day-to-day operations, I'm still a partner in that business, but it's passive income. And we don't have solid information, or we're just now beginning to explore the information on the Schedule E about what information is available for active and passive, or it's passive and non-passive, but to highlight the distinction, I'm using passive and active. So there hasn't been, other than the Oregon policy, there hasn't been a lot of discussion about that distinction, but it did come up during the session about how we get from the policy we currently have to changing that policy. And so that's an important distinction, that the policy we have now is for active business income, not passive business income. And so it seems a relevant policy consideration as you discuss the appropriate tax rates. Do we want to make that distinction between those two types or not? And it kind of wraps around to C corporations and the taxation of C corporations and the so-called double tax, where a C corporation has its profits, it pays its taxes, and then the profit after tax are the dividends that it pays out to people. And then the households who receive those dividends pay income tax on that. And I touch on that in the example on the last page. But I just wanted to highlight that point. This is an area that I'm continuing to try and get better information, especially, well, to state the obvious, we're not sure what's going to happen at the federal level, but if they go down this path and if Oregon continues down this path, this distinction may become more important and more clear, or it may go away. But we have stepped into this world. So I just have I have two charts with the rates, and then I get to the examples. And these are the first chart here are the C corporation marginal tax rates. And this bottom line here is the Oregon, and that's supposed to be a dashed line. So for the C corporation rates for Oregon, we have our 6.6% up to a million, and then 7.6. A couple things about this. Note that I stopped here at about $1 million or $1.2 million, and it goes on, but there might be some changes further on, but then I lose all of this distinction here. It's a presentation issue. So this is kind of chopped off at about $1 million. But I wanted to highlight the marginal rates here for the corporation so that the federal level, the rates start about 15% and then go up to 25%, and there's a block here that's taxed at 38%, and then settles down to 34%, and then eventually hits 35%. And that's the number that's in the media, that C corporations face this 35% corporate tax rate. So combining these two for corporations in Oregon, their combined rate tends to be on average, or not on average, but for a large stretch, are about 40%, and it'll tick up to a 42% or so. And the income here is, this is how marginal brackets work, is the first chunk of income gets taxed at the 15%, the next chunk of income the 25%, and so forth. And it's important to understand the marginal rate structure, because in terms of behavioral responses, the marginal rate is what can drive those decisions. As taxpayers understand what marginal rate they're in, that will have more of a determinant on their behavioral response. The prior effective tax rates and total tax rates are helpful in understanding the overall burden. The behavioral responses are driven more by marginal tax rates. And here, the pass-through marginal tax rates, these are the personal income tax rates. So for Oregon, and I have the title here, active income, these rates are not the 5, 7, 9, and 9.9% for wage income. That's our core structure. These are the rates that are the active income. So it's the 7%, 7.2%, 7.6%. These rates have been in effect since 2015. And these brackets here are for joint filers. And again, they just highlight how the marginal rates increase as income increases.
Question?
Yeah.
Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you go back to the last slide? So those marginal rates there, that's the primary reason why we have so much capital sitting offshore from corporations. Is that correct?
That's the discussion so forth about if they bring it back, they're going to trip into this 35% tax rate.
So by, you know, the discussion is to bring the federal corporation tax down to 15%. That's supposed to stimulate the corporations to bring that capital back to the country.
That's what proponents of that policy argue. As with most things, and there's probably some truth to that, it can get a lot more complicated for any given corporation because they have profits sitting, if you're talking about a worldwide corporation, they have profits sitting in whatever countries, and they're managing their worldwide tax burden. And it also depends on where their investment opportunities are. So there are those who agree and those who disagree with whether or not that would actually happen, but that is the argument, is that they're going to get dinged for 35%, so if it gets lowered. Now, balancing that would be getting at some of the eliminating some of the deductions or other tax preferences. But that 35% is the proponents of that, that's what they argue. But it's also important to realize the investment opportunity. Any one corporation is going to look at its whole picture, where can it best invest those for future growth and greater profits. So it's complicated.
Theoretically, though, if the corporation does do that, brings the money back onshore, that would increase its tax liability for the state of Oregon.
Correct. Yeah, we would piggyback onto that. Yeah, that's true.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So the last slide here, because everybody loves charts full of numbers. So to end on a low note here, and this really gets at some of the examples. There are a lot of assumptions that go into these. And so for those people who will be sending emails about how this is incorrect, I can communicate with them. But there are a lot of details that go into these. Now, the three columns here are the types of businesses that we've been talking about: sole props, pass-throughs, and corporations. This last column here, corporate dividends, and I'll get to those last. So just walking through this, we have a business, a hypothetical business, that has $1 million in profit. And the sole proprietor has one taxpayer, that's the single business owner. The pass-through entity has two. And these are all just by my construct to try and convey a simple point. And they split the profit evenly. And the corporation itself is just one taxpayer, but the C corporation has two shareholders, and each of those receive their corporate dividends. So marching through these, we have the sole proprietor with $1 million in profit. They don't pay any business income tax, so that's not a separate entity. That $1 million is subject to the personal income taxes. And people tend to like examples with the joint filer and two kids, the family of four, and that's the core thing that I've used here. So that $1 million results in about $295,000 in tax. That's with an average itemized deduction. It's kind of averaged everything. They are in the top marginal tax bracket at 39.6 at the federal level. But that $295,000 represents just under 30% effective tax rate, if you will. In Oregon, they don't pay a business income tax, but they do pay about $90,000 in Oregon income tax, and they're at the 9.9% bracket in Oregon. So their combined federal and Oregon tax liability is about $385,000. So we take that same business, those same assumptions, and instead of a sole proprietor, it's a pass-through, it's a partnership or an S-corp with two shareholders or two partners, and they divide that profit evenly, $500,000 each. And each of them is a family of four, joint filer. And their combined tax is $230,000. That's $115,000 for each of them. They're set up identical. Their marginal tax rate at the federal level is 35%. Because the income is divided two ways, they're two sets of itemized deductions, one for each family. So the $1 million in profit is subject to a lesser tax. And that's simply going from one person to two. In Oregon, they pay the $150 minimum tax, and they pay $71,000 in Oregon income tax. And these are the pass-through preferential rates, and they are in the 7.2% bracket. So their net tax is just under $302,000. So you take the same business, whether it's a sole prop or a two-person pass-through, and the tax difference is about $84,000. So now we take that same business, and we're going to call it a C corporation. It's a single taxpayer with two shareholders, but that $1 million is taxed at the federal level. It's 34%, so that's a tax of $340,000. And in Oregon, they're just at the top end of the 6.6% bracket, so they're paying 6.6%. So their combined tax is $406,000. So that's just on the entity itself. So here we can see if kind of the core point here is for the C corporation, they're paying $406,000 in tax, but if they organize as a pass-through, their tax gets cut by about $95,000.
And that's one of the complaints in the business community, is that the C corps feel like the pass-throughs aren't paying their proportional share. And that was one of the things that helped us high center in our discussion during the session.
Right. And that the intent here was to highlight that point. I mean, there are a lot of assumptions here that go into these, because for the pass-through, once you step into the personal income tax side, now it's actually a little bit simpler with the active income tax rate, because to choose these lower tax rates, the taxpayers have to forego their Schedule A deductions. But that still highlights and that's a significant difference in tax here, just on this very simplified.
And it would be higher, wouldn't it, if that C corp was over $1 million, so you'd be up to the 7.6?
Correct. For every dollar over $1 million, the tax rate becomes 7.6%. Yeah, it's the marginal piece. That's marginal nature.
Senator Birdsugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things I want to point out is, one, if we go after the pastors, they're just going to become C-Corps. The other thing you're missing on here, Chris, is you also have to point out, So let's go to the sole proprietor, the $89,000, the tax there. That also becomes a deduction on the following year's federal income tax, correct?
Correct.
Which is significant for the next year.
All of this, and this is where, for better or worse, this can get a lot more complicated, and
well,
you really,
me, yes.
this is again, it seems like the only path we could go down is more complicated in terms of trying to understand all of the nuances. Well, they're not even nuances; it's just how the tax code plays out. All of the taxes are deductible. Taxes paid are deductible, and so there's this cross deductibility going on, and some of that is actually a discussion that I'm. At the end of today, Paul's going to talk about the SALT deduction at the federal level. But that is correct. The taxes paid are deductible.
So I just give an example in my business environment, because there's corporations and S-corps and partnerships and all that. We're always in a three-year tax planning mode. We're always looking out and projecting 3 years all the time to see which, you know, where you... You weave and dodge, I call it. Weave and dodge. And it's, you know, I mean, that's, I think any business that does that, I mean, that's why you hire accountants and they run different models and come back to you and you scratch your head. But that's what goes on, because it is very complicated. It takes a lot of planning.
Chris, Senator Bertschinger said something like you could just change from a pass-through back to a C corporation, but real... What's involved with that? There's more than just money and those kind of considerations, isn't there? I mean, it's not so simple as mailing in a new form.
No, and it is very complicated. There are a lot of considerations. Liability is a big one. Taxes are often there. The nature of shareholders can also be a factor. S corporate, all of the shareholders in an S corp, for example, have to be people. Partnerships and C-corps, you can get into these very complicated entity structures. You know, partnerships can be partners in a partnership. Businesses, you can have a partnership that consists of two partners. I mean, a partnership that consists of two partnerships. And then it can get very entangled. Now, that probably isn't the case for most of these businesses. I mean, when we some preliminary information on the number of partnerships is most of them, about half of them, a partnership consists of two partners, and they tend to be people. But you can also have partnerships that have more than 1,000 partners or even sometimes 100,000 partners. So the nature of those entities are probably very different, where the two-person partnership is going to be what people think of as running a business, whether it's manufacturing or some sort of service firm. But the 100,000 partnerships, those might just be financial investment, you know, created temporary structures. And then, so some of those aren't even amenable to really going to a C corporation. And one of the values of a C corporation is going public. If you really want to raise capital and you want to go into, you want to be sold on an exchange and you want to go to the public, any entity can raise capital through private equity firms or smaller markets, if you will. But if you really want to go public, that's where you go. You have to go C corporation. You have to go public, and then you come under the eye of the SEC. And so now that's a whole other world where you have to pay attention to the federal agencies keeping an eye on what you're doing, because you're selling your stock to the public at large.
But you also could sell your stock without going public on the private market.
Yes, you have closely held C corporations, so you don't have to go that route. So that's a consideration. And the last piece here in terms of C corporation taxation, we have what gets often referred to as the double taxation. So the corporate dividends here, again, are tied to this C corporation, where we have the $1 million in profit. They pay out the federal tax and the state tax, and what's left over is their dividends, $594,000. So the $1 million minus the $406,000 is $594,000 in dividends. That gets paid out to the two shareholders in equal amounts. So on their personal income tax return, they file their federal return, and the total tax is $122,000 for each of them. So it's about $61,000 per, and that dividend income isn't subject to the statutory rates. It's subject, I mean, the marginal rates. It's subject to what I've used here is a the 20% rate for the first $250,000, and then 23.8% for the amount above $250,000. And so they're in this marginal rate at 23.8, and the effective tax rate is just over 20% for this dividend income, because it's taxed differently from wage income. And then when we get to Oregon, we don't have that distinction, so dividend income is taxed the same as wage income in Oregon. It's subject to the 9.9% marginal rate. And the dividends here in total for the federal and state for the two shareholders is $168,000. And so the notion of the double taxation, we'd get at the 406 plus the 167. What's important to keep in mind there is that the entities we're talking about are a bit different, where the C corporation is itself and the dividends are the individual shareholders of that C corporation. And the way I've structured it here, they're the two shareholders in the corporation, and they're, you know, they're actively involved in that corporation. But the dividends, this would be, you know, Nike or Intel stock that if they pay dividends, or Microsoft, they pay dividends. It's that kind of income. But just so you're aware of that double taxation piece. And so if you include that, then that distinction between the tax liability of C corporations versus non-C corporations even gets heightened a little bit further. But that also gets into the dividends are by definition going to be passive income. Okay. So that's leaves us somewhere.
Well put.
Chapter one.
Leaves us somewhere. But there is a lot of information. Again, just trying to focus on this piece, and hopefully this will spur some thought and some additional questions as we get into, if the committee so chooses, further chapters of the nature of these businesses, the kinds of businesses, and the relevant and the importance of the taxation, whether it should be the same or different, or the tax burden responsibility of the different types of businesses, depending on how one looks at it.
Any questions or comments? Chris, this has been a really informative discussion, and it does reveal the real problem we have with trying to put an equitable business tax out there, or a revision, or to modernize it from its beginning in 1929, the same year the Model T was produced. So there's clearly a dilemma there on how to achieve fairness, C-corps, S-corps, and how to move forward. So you're right, it leaves us somewhere. So thank you very much for that. Let's take a 5-minute phone and bathroom break and come back to...
we'll see if we thought that would fit well. In
yeah, we'll have a drink after this. So,
thank you.
All right, we'll come back to order here. And we want to take a look at some of the OLCC revenue trends, because that's a big part of our revenue system.
Thank you, Chair, Committee. For the record, my name is Bill Schutte. I'm the economist for OLCC. Normally on these presentations, I'd be accompanied by our Executive Director, Steve Marks, but he's out of town on business, so if there are higher-level policy questions that I cannot answer or should not answer, I will certainly pass them on to him. I'm going to go through a brief overview again of the liquor system and just the liquor system. Of course, you know we have recreational marijuana as well. I'll go in a little bit deeper dive of how the revenue is generated, how we go from the gross revenues to the net revenues. We'll talk about our recent retail expansion, the why and where we're at with that, and then end up with a little bit on detail on beer and wine taxes as well. So with that, we'll get started. Again, if there are newer committee members here, the history of the OLCC, again, was created in 1933 after Prohibition. legislature determined the control system was the best model for serving the community in the interest of making alcohol legally available. The state has the exclusive right to sell distilled spirits. Profits from these sales are captured at the wholesale and retail levels and returned to benefit state and local governments. That's what I'll be talking about primarily here today. And of course, what I will not be talking about, but feel free if you want to ask questions, the addition of recreational marijuana regulation with the passage of Measure 91. So what do? We license businesses that sell alcohol. We issue service permits to those that serve alcohol. We manage and distribute distilled spirits, regulate those businesses, produce public information on the responsible use of alcohol. We have an administrative hearings unit, so if people get into trouble with alcohol law, we have a due process for that, allows them to go through that. Regulation of Oregon's bottle bill, and of course the regulation of recreational marijuana. Just a quick overview of the licensees, over 15,000 licensees in the state, 7,400 bar and restaurants, what we call on-premises licenses, almost 5,000 off-premises licenses, grocery stores, convenience stores, over 1,100 wineries, and I'll get more into the winery stuff, but those are really winery locations, so they're not all operating wineries. Some are wine warehouses, some are secondary locations. 330 brew pubs, 1,400 distributors, wholesalers, and 96 distilleries. One of the big things in the bottom is the 8,900 special event licenses we issue every year for concerts and food fairs and that sort of thing, and almost 160,000 alcohol service permits. Just to look at where the liquor stores are located, most of them are located in large metro areas, but we do have a scattering in the eastern part of the state. 269 stores currently, 94 what they call exclusive, which are primarily sell liquor, 175 non-exclusive, which sell liquor and other things. The recent expansion has been more towards non-exclusive stores, especially in metro areas, and the other things are beer and wine that they're selling out of there. So here we have the distilled spirits model. Many of you might have seen this bottle before, but this really is how we generate money, the overview of that. So 49% of this average $17 per bottle is the manufacturer's cost. I should note that this does include the federal excise tax on liquor. It's not in our control, but when it comes in our warehouse, that tax has already been paid. So of that $8.49, about $2 of that is federal excise tax that comes in manufacturer's cost. 9% to that green next layer is the commission paid to our liquor store operators. 1% in the bank card cost, and I'll highlight that a little bit as we go through our financials. We do pick up the credit card costs for all transactions for liquor in the state, our sales of liquor in the state, and then the middle layer, 4% for OLCC operating expenses, and that is not just the warehouse, but also includes enforcement, licensing, administration, and distribution functions. And then that the revenue we generate is that 37% net profit that goes into the state coffers in cities and counties. A little primer on the markup formula for distilled liquor. One of the kind of the fallacies or that we look at is the state sets the price. We set what the state does is set the markup formula. And this is a very complicated formula. I won't go into it. I have an example later on of how it works, but the average markup from the manufacturer's cost is about 104% over the average cost. The formula's purpose is to assign a higher markup to lower value products and a lower markup to higher value products. And the idea of moderating consumption of the lower value products. So this is the markup formula in work, in practice. So a landed cost at the top of the table, $4.38, would be marked up 127%. And retail at $9.95. As you will notice, most of the liquor retailed in the state is something $9.95. So that's why this example goes to. At the higher end, a $16, $17 bottle coming into the state is retailing at $32.95 and has a 96% markup. I have included the average price of the various categories, so the premixed cocktails, rum, vodka, are marked up higher than the Canadian whiskeys and domestic whiskeys. Domestic whiskeys and tequilas, And the Irish whiskeys and scotches are marked up less because they're higher value. A little bit about the 50-cent surcharge. That is in our markup formula. The current surcharge was established back in 2009 when the state was looking at some financial difficulties and liquor sales started to moderate a little bit. It has to be renewed every biennium. The current 50-cent surcharge per bottle, which is added right on the top of the markup formula, has been extended through June 30th, 2019. In this biennium, it's expected to generate $35.4 million and all this revenue goes by statute to the general fund. Again, this has to be renewed by the commission every biennium. Part of the surcharge is it often is and now is included as a standard part of our budget from the governor's recommended budget all the way through the legislative approved budget. Here's the pie chart on gross revenues. Of course, the great majority of our gross revenues come from distilled spirits, a smaller amount from liquor license fees, about $13 million, $38 million in the upcoming biennium from beer and wine tax, miscellaneous revenue, sales to federal casinos and that sort of thing, and some other revenues that come in from recycling and other miscellaneous types of things. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to drill down, because generally we have the next pie chart as a distribution, but what I want to do is drill through kind of a profit loss statement about how we get from this part to the actual distribution of revenue. So at the top of the profit loss statement, we have the $1.35 billion in liquor sales. The first deduction is the licensee discount. That is the sales to bars and restaurants. Bars and restaurants get a 5% discount off the cost of liquor. So that gets taken off the top. The net liquor sales and then the cost of goods with a gross margin of about $713 million expected for the 17-19 biennium. And then added to those revenues, privilege tax for wine and beer, liquor licensing fees, miscellaneous revenues, and a shared service allocation from the marijuana program. When the marijuana program was set up, we received significant positions and other resources for support services because it was expanding the size of the agency. And part of the budget process is money is moved from the marijuana program to the liquor program for those support services. So the bottom line is 17-19 looking at about $767 million in gross revenues. And then from that, we take out the expenditures. The biggest top line is the store operating expenses. That's the 9% of sales, $124 million that goes to the liquor agents. And then the various programs that are funded in the OLCC, the distilled spirits program, which includes that line item for credit cards. Again, we pick up the credit card costs for liquor sales in the state, which are expected to be about $14 million this biennium, the cost of the wholesale operations, retail services, and then below that, public safety services for licensing, server education enforcement, and then support services division, which includes our tax collection, financial services, IT administration, so on. And a smaller line for capital improvement. I should note that line was significantly larger last biennium for a replacement we did on our roof and expansion of our conveyor system. But that is our general capital improvement or operating budget for any given biennium. So total expenditures of about $192 million. And then the distribution of that revenue. So the gross revenues minus the expenditures. About $576 million expected in the upcoming biennium. The distribution of revenue is in statute. There is a small amount that we collect for the Oregon Wine Board, 2 cents off of every gallon of wine sold in the state, mental health, general fund, incorporated city services. And so this is how we really get to the actual meat of the distribution itself. And here, again, is a graphical representation of that distribution. So a little bit about our current retail expansion efforts. This is a slide from our budget presentation, so I decided to include it because it includes not just the what, but it includes the why we're doing the distilled program retail expansion. Basically, during the 80s, and this is when the state actually ran the state liquor stores, the ratio of outlets to population was about one outlet per 12,000. That kind of stayed in place, but then at the beginning of the contract system and towards the end of the last year, that had risen to about one outlet per 16,000. So there was a decision made by the commission to look at expanding the number of retail outlets to get back to that 1 to 12,000 ratio. Rationale for the request was expansion of liquor stores and distilleries created stress on the OLC's resources. And part of our budget request is we got the addition of one district manager, that's who manages the liquor stores out there and supports them, and one business analyst that would assist with evaluating the markets and proposals for expansion. The expansion program itself, we started in Portland metro area, Clackamas, Multnomah, Washington counties, added 14 new locations. We moved second to the Eugene area, Lane, Lynn, Benton counties, and added six new locations. Currently, we are in the Eastern Oregon Region 3, Phase 3, where we have now 32 applications, and the commission will be looking at those and making recommendations for new stores there in the October 26-27 meeting. But further on, we plan on moving to Southern Oregon and up to the coast and maybe even back to Region 1 again. There is some feeling, especially in areas like Washington County, that with the market isn't totally being filled there with what we consider an adequate number of liquor stores, and we may be coming back to Western Washington or Eastern Washington County for that. The process itself is not typical. Typically, when a liquor store is replaced, we interview people and it go back into that same or similar location. We are looking at this process as an open recruitment, market-driven process for appointing a goal of approximately 62 new liquor agents. This is from the beginning of the program last year to target of 310 new outlets, again, to get back to that roughly 1 to 12,000 ratio. With the objective to improve customer convenience by adding retail liquor locations with a measured but consistent approach to growth. Differences from the existing process is applicants may apply for multiple locations. Currently in our liquor store system, one agent can only own a maximum of two stores, so we're looking at to change that a little bit. Existing liquor store agents can apply for more than two contracts under the open recruitment. They must be minor control plans. So in most liquor stores, there's a single entrance, but if they propose to us a control plan that does not have a separate entrance, they have to have the reason, the rationale, security plan to be approved by the commission. It's open to a variety of different business models where customers can purchase spirits. That includes spirits inside existing businesses, a traditional liquor store, a boutique retail location, and maybe even in grocery stores. Again, a part of is looking for market-focused creativity, innovation, entrepreneurs. The picture on the right is the Bethany grocery store that has a store within a store, as it's called. All types of retail models we're looking at with a wide range of choices for customers. And the selection criteria for these new stores, those selections are made by the commission, looking at the business proposal. Do they have adequate capital investment and financing to pull these off? Retail or business experience, some knowledge or better knowledge of the alcohol industry. But one of the big criteria is location, and we are very cognizant on the impact on existing agents. And one of the primary scoring criteria, and what we look at scoring these things, and also how the commission looks at them is, you know, how far away or what potential impact could be on existing agents. Also looking at convenience and, of course, the estimated sales and revenue off of this. So, summary of the recap, the current goal of expansion is to get to 310 stores by the end of June of 2019. We started with 248 stores at the beginning of expansion in 2016. Currently 248 have been added, 10 to date are actually up and operating. 10 additional store locations have been approved but are not open. A lot of reasons for this. Some are doing build-outs, actually building them. Some are doing finding leases. Some are doing remodels. There were some issues with some of the agents or new stores wanted to use their own POS systems, and we had legislation changed this last session, Senate Bill 1044, that will allow for that, what they call ACH transfers or bank-to-bank transfers that will allow them to use their own POS systems. So with note that the four of those outlets that were approved were in Walmart grocery stores. One primary blockade was this whole banking issue, which we hopefully have resolved in the last legislative session. So the revenue is related to expansion. In our legislative budget, we were provided resources to do the expansion, but the legislature also requested us to raise our revenue increase by 3%. So I'll talk a little bit, a little graphical representation on the next slide, but that 3% revenue over forecast is approximately equal to $39.4 million. $17.2 million additional, this would result in $17.2 million in additional distributable revenue, or $9.6 million for the general fund. But as you can see, here's a trending of those revenue trends. The bottom line is the $1.31 billion, and the top line is the $1.34 billion. We are currently trending closer to the $1.31 billion, but we still have 22 months left in the biennium. The stores have been opening a little bit slower than we thought. That was the basis for the $1.34 billion or the 3% increase. We hope to achieve that, but again, it's on a month-to-month basis, and we will keep OEA and others updated on how this is progressing. But and we are also looking at other ways to potentially achieve more revenue, too, through maybe looking at agents' comp, but also alterations of the markup formula and perhaps different lines of products. Types out there. So a little bit about the Oregon Distillers. Oregon Distillers are a significant part of liquor sales in the state of Oregon. The gross sales, and I'm going back to a single year, fiscal year 2017, were about $600 million. Of that, about $76 million, or 13% of the sales, came from Oregon distilleries. 69 of those came through liquor stores themselves, through our boarhouse system and through our state contracted liquor stores. But distillers also have the ability, if they apply and get approval, to sell throughout their own locations. They're also known as distillery agents. And this has been a rapidly growing area. About 7 million of these sales were directly out of distilleries themselves or distillery agencies or their designated locations. The growth in distillery licenses has been impressive over the last several years, almost 13% annual growth. Again, 500 products or Oregon products in our system, and 13% of all liquor sales. We're always interested, and there's always interest in what's selling in Oregon. And so here's a top 20 list of the distilled spirit sales for all size categories in the state. And the ones highlighted in green are Oregon products. So you probably recognize Pendleton Canadian Whiskey, HRD Vodka. Again, Oregon products are very significant to our system. And so we want to do as much as we can to take care of our Oregon distilleries. And a little bit about beer and wine tax collection. Just to review, Oregon has established excise taxes for beer and wine, 8 cents per gallon for beer, or 260 per 31-gallon barrel, 67 cents per gallon for table wine, that's 14% and under alcohol by volume, 77 cents per gallon for dessert wine, or fortified wine as it's called, which is over 14% alcohol by volume. I'll note that the actual tax is 65 cents and 75 cents. The additional 2 cents is what goes to the Oregon Wine Board and was that $667,000, which is passed on to them to help with the funding their operations. Beer and wine taxes are collected mostly at the wholesale tier of the system. A review of the alcohol system, not just Oregon, but all systems, is what they call the three-tier system, manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers. They are separate statutorily designated systems that a manufacturer cannot sell directly through a retailer, although there are some exceptions to that. But the large part of the alcohol through the state for beer and wine goes through distributors, wholesalers, and that's where the tax is collected. And it's a very efficient way to collect tax as well because there's not that many of them. Some of the tax is collected at the manufacturer level from directly from wineries and brew pubs, and I'll give a breakdown on that of where all that comes from. Tax collections for the last fiscal year were about $18 million. Beer and wine retailed through licensed off-premises outlets such as grocery stores and convenience stores, but also as retail can be retailed through wineries and brew pubs. So a little bit about Oregon's beer industry, 332 brewery brew pubs. In 2014, this employed almost 7,000 people. It's probably over 7,000 now, I would guess. We did an analysis back in 2013 of the reports that they were sending us, and back then, almost 63% of that production was being exported out of the state. So it's a significant economic impact to the state of Oregon, almost $2.8 billion by the data provided by the Beer Institute. And again, the growth in brewing and brew pub licenses, 12% annual growth, again, very impressive. I mean, it is a growing industry in Oregon, continues to be a growing industry, and again, something we want to support as an agency. But the question is, again, who pays the beer taxes in Oregon? So here is a breakdown of license types. Brewery, brew pubs, warehouse. A warehouse is a license type which allows not just storage, but also bottling. Warehouse license type would be a particular industry such as Miller, Coors, Budweiser, that sort of thing, which will allow them to do bottling in it. Wholesaler are your typical big distributors, what are called WMBWs, wineries. The bulk of the beer tax paid in Oregon is by the warehouses, the Miller, Coors warehouses and those types. And the wholesalers, Southern Wine and Spirits and Young's Market are the big distributors in the state. But 18% paid directly by the brewery and brew pubs, 2% by the wineries. Interesting about wineries is even though wineries are malt beverage, or wineries are considered wineries, they do produce malt beverage in the form of cider. So to produce cider, you generally have to have a winery license, which is something that is unique in the state of Oregon. But we had to put them somewhere. Most ciders are, in the malt beverage category, but they use a lot of the same equipment as wineries. So that's where we decided to put them. So a little overview of Oregon's wine industry. Almost 1,100 Oregon wine licenses exist now. Again, this isn't all wineries in the state. There are about 702 producing wineries in 2015. If you move wine to a warehouse or a storage facility that is off your winery license, that has to be licensed as well. Average winery license costs about $250 a year, so this is what many wineries or some like to do. Wine industry also includes cider producers, and as I mentioned, the wine storage facilities as well. In 2013, when we looked at the industry, the wine industry employed about 17,000 people. Most of those are in rural Oregon. Related wages top $527 million, and wine-related tourism contributed almost $208 million to the Oregon economy. Industry is expected to be worth at least $3.5 billion right now. The annual growth of winery license is more of a linear growth. It's not as much as breweries and brew pubs, but it's still on a growth curve, a growth of about 8% annual. So it is a growing industry within the state. But again, who pays the wine taxes in Oregon? And this is, even though we pride ourselves on our malt beverage and our beer industry and our wine industry, most of the wine coming through the state is still coming through the wholesalers and warehouses. And so in this case, most of the wine tax, 84%, is paid by the wholesalers or distributors, a little bit less by warehouses. About 7% of the wine is paid by the Oregon wineries themselves. At the bottom here, I included a statistic on the small winery exemption. If you're not aware of the small winery exemption, it's unique to Oregon. It's in statute. It exempts the first 40,000 gallons from taxation if producing under 100,000 gallons annually. So when you look at that for all the different license types, and we have to look at them for all the license types because of commerce rules, that's about $2 million. So the small winery exemption not only has to apply to Oregon wineries, but also applies to out-of-state wineries if they can prove that they produce under 100,000 gallons. Otherwise, we'd get in trouble with the feds if we just applied it to Oregon wineries. So with that, I'll end and see if there are any questions. Or
thank you. Some interesting factoids there. One thing that I observed there was during that recession that we had, your lines continued to go up.
Yes.
On sales and distributorships and all of that. I do want to ask you about online competition. I'm on a page right now from Liquor Barn, and where it's in Illinois somewhere where you can order your spirits. Has that had any effect on anything?
Senator Hahn's committee, I am not aware of that. At this point, the online liquor system is something we are looking at, but we haven't really addressed fully. We don't think it's a significant part of the state. But it's something I will get back to you. There may be several legal issues in there, too, that they would have to pay the markup as they come into the state. So that is something we really haven't looked at extensively.
The questions for the OLCC, Senator Bertschreger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On our contract liquor stores, at what point do they pay for the product?
The product is paid for. The state pays for the product once it crosses the threshold of the warehouse. So part of the liquor store system we have is what we call a bailment system. So we do not have to pay for the product when it comes into the warehouse. But once it is shipped to the liquor store, that is when we have to pay for the liquor at that point.
When does the contract liquor store pay for it?
We pay for it. So, then the liquor store owner makes a sale and remits all those proceeds into a treasury account.
Then withholds 9%.
Yes.
The questions.
That's pretty good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Very informative. Kyle, Paul, you want to move to some property tax relief?
Yeah, please. My bill would have done that last session. Property tax relief.
Sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
I'd take that trade.
Yeah, you're the one.
So, Mr. Chair, we've been working on property tax relief, of course, with this committee for at least a couple of years now, and we've looked at it in the context of overall property tax reform. But we've also tried to start thinking about it some, in perhaps in the context of a state revenue package, where it would be a state program. So Kyle's going to give you kind of an overview of what our thinking is and some background on some of the work that he's done as you think ahead to the next session on where a relief might fit into an overall plan.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, as Paul was saying, I'm going to be working off of, there's a PDF document in the meeting materials and OLIS related to property tax relief, and this is primarily going to be relief related to a homeowner or perhaps a renter as well. What I have here is kind of the outline of what I was going to step through today, the context for the discussion. Paul touched on this, of course. This is in the larger discussion of property tax reform that's been in front of this committee for a number of sessions now. I figured I'd hit on some of the existing and historical property tax relief programs that are here in Oregon now and in the past, some of the growth trends, and also the ownership and renter costs. So that's to set the stage a little bit of some of the costs that a homeowner or a renter might have, and perhaps tee up maybe some of the need, if you will, of where relief could be applied. through the system. And then also I'll finish up with some potential programs. So, of course, there's the homestead exemption, and circuit breakers are two similar programs, but they can be administered in different ways and tailored in different ways depending upon what it is you're trying to achieve, and also is it part of a larger reform, property tax, or even one of the other tax programs as well. So again, for the context, in terms of property tax reform, one of the things that this committee has certainly been looking at is moving from this maximum assessed value, or this assessed value approach, back to a real market value, so tax on the real market value of a property, and then instituting what's been in front of the committee, at least, has been instituting a homestead exemption. So that's been part of, it would be referred to the voters to change the Constitution, and then there have been requirements that the legislature will institute a homestead exemption of some sort. And, of course, the benefit of leaving that to the legislature is allowing that to be adjusted in statute rather than putting something in place in the Constitution that 15 years from now could be causing headaches or issues that can't be changed easily by the legislature. So putting it in statute has been the approach so far. And I have referenced SJR 3 was the most recent one in 2017, of course, required that homestead exemption as part of the constitutional change. So this is a slide this committee's seen before as part of previous presentations I have. I have this more of just as somewhat of a reminder in some cases of, in some cases, the difficulty or just the framework that we have currently around this state. And the attempt here is, and there's a lot going on in the slide, but is to show that difference between that maximum assessed value or that assessed value and the real market value of properties throughout the state and also in different counties. And this is for residential class property, so it's going to pick up most of those that would be homeowner-occupied properties, but certainly not all. And you can see in the box plots down below, you can see the different counties. You do have this difference between assessed value and real market value, and that difference between those two values certainly can vary by county to county. You can see Multnomah County, Deschutes, Clatsop are some of those that have that greater disparity between assessed value and real market value than some of the maybe perhaps more rural counties that don't have that same difference. So when you shift, if you were to shift to a real market value, you would see a greater lift in certain counties than others, and then how you'd apply a homestead exemption could take that into account. But that also speaks to just where we are today of taxing below real market value, the tale of two houses, and that whole disparity that's been ongoing for a number of years now.
I think maybe you should explain the rhombus and the whisker and the box plot.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and this again, this was a slide presented before, and it's a pretty rough rough output. So the idea is the box and the box plot is going to cover 50% of the accounts, and then the whiskers are kind of like the high and the low. And so those are predominantly going to be outliers in some cases. I didn't do much to really adjust the data. I was just trying to throw some figures up here to give you some sense of it. But that middle line, that's going to be the median. That's in the middle of the box. So if you're talking just using, I guess, Multnomah County, this is, would be an individual property's change property ratio. So that's just the ratio of real market value to assessed value. And you can see the average and right, the median pretty much is right there about 60% or so. So their assessed value is about 60% of their real market value. And there's definitely some variation in the different accounts within Multnomah County, and that's really what the box is trying to explain here is just, even though the average might be 60%, there's still quite a bit of variation in different properties, and this is all comes from growth that we've seen since 1998, and that's where it was fixed.
The tale of two houses is the top of that box and the bottom of that box?
Exactly, Mr. Chair, yes.
And those two disparate values still, and or they're the same value and they're paying different bills?
Right, yeah, and that's exactly it. So if you have one that's 80% of their real market value and another's a 60%, both homes could be worth $300,000, but one's paying tax on a much lower value. Their assessed value is lower. And again, that keys off of really where you've seen the growth in a lot of cases, because these are values that were fixed and can grow 3% since 1998. So I think there's been definitely maps circulating in the Portland area where you see different growth in different areas, and that's where you get that tale of two houses. Where you've seen more growth, they're paying less in terms of a real market value today than properties that haven't seen that growth or areas that haven't seen that growth.
Yeah.
Kyle, I don't know if you've looked at California at all, but when they had that proposition, was it 13?
13.
13. You know, if a person stays in their house and never sells it, they're paying a lot less taxes than the person. So they even have a bigger tale to tell in California. So we have to keep that in perspective, too. It's not just Oregon that has a tale of two houses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Senator, that can be even neighbor by neighbor, where mm-hmm. you have a neighbor that just purchased a home or one that's been in the home for 20 years, and you have the disparity neighbor by neighbor, where here in Oregon it's a little more sub-neighborhood, I guess, where neighborhoods that have grown. But that's part of certainly one of the things we hear is, well, what about resetting at sale? In some cases, you'll run into other issues that I guess California is a good example of.
Yeah. Well, no one's proposing trying to emulate California's policies.
I remember you said that.
Okay, and then again, this was another slide I've shown before, and it's just maybe a reminder of these are the different county median RMVs, and it's important to keep in mind in designing a homestead exemption is a homestead exemption, if you do a flat amount, say $50,000, that $50,000 will mean a lot different things in, say, Wheeler County, which has the lowest median real market value of residential properties, and Multnomah County. So we've talked about you could do a percentage of value or something on those lines, but it's a little more murky than just saying, here's your homestead exemption of $50,000, $100,000. In some counties, you could eliminate taxes on 70% of residential properties, where in others, you're giving a 20% or a 30% reduction in value. So it just speaks that there are certainly differences in different counties throughout the state. Okay, so in terms of property tax relief programs, the first thing I was just going to hit on is just even Oregon's base structure today. So that's with Measure 5 and Measure 50 in place. And, of course, this is Oregon's base system for property taxes, but there is still some relief in some cases built in, really, because you're no longer keying off of that real market value. That was Measure 50. And then Measure 5 has those overall limits on both the education side and the non-education side. So there is some relief built into the program the way it is designed today. The first chart I guess I would reference is just property taxes as a percent of Oregon personal income. So this goes back from the 70s up to 2016. And you can see this level shift that occurred post Measure 5 and then also Measure 50 coming into effect. Prior to those two measures, on average, property taxes were about 5.1% of Oregon personal income. Post those two, and this is, I guess, post Measure 5 and then Measure 50 coming into effect in the later 90s, you're at about 3.3%, and that's fairly steady. So the change really is that level shift down, and it's maintained there more or less since those two measures went through. And then also just an example, you can see, and these are real weighted figures around the state, but on average over from 2012 to 2017, we've seen growth about 5.1% real market value. Maximum satisfied would be 3%. So taxes are going up a little bit more than 3% just because there's bond levies and other new districts that come online that voters approve. But you can see if you were keying just off of real market value, you could see growth up to 5.1%. Of course, it depends upon what the local taxing districts impose. Whereas today, you see those 3% growth limits. So there is built in or baked into Oregon's current system is you do have some protection against just growing, I guess, property taxes growing faster than other things to key off of. And I'll actually have a chart on that of comparing it to inflation and different sources of income and such too. But so those are existing. You also have the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program. I think the committee is pretty familiar with this, but again, it's for seniors and disabled individuals to more or less borrow to pay for their property taxes. So the state pays it, they repay it at time of sale of their property or following their passing and the property is sold. Those property taxes are repaid and it accrues a 6% interest. So it's not an exemption per se, it's just more of a state financed loan to cover those property taxes. On the income tax side of things, this was actually pulled from a presentation our office did related to housing and support of different housing programs through both the property tax system and the income tax system. In this list is just the deduction, the itemized deduction for property taxes. And that's, it's kind of interesting, and I have the next slide goes into a little more detail, but in some ways you can think there's almost a property tax relief or homestead exemption, or however you want to phrase it, there is some relief related to the itemized deduction for property taxes. So if you're an itemizer, you get a deduct, and this is connected to the federal deduction, you get to deduct your property taxes from your income. So what I have here is a chart taken from the governor's tax expenditure report, and you can see listed here it has, you have the income by the filer group, and then the average deduction. So this is the property taxes they're paying. So if we're just using those with an income greater than about $85,000, the average deduction was $4,600. So that would be their property tax liability. That results in an average revenue impact or benefit, average revenue reduction to the filer, the tax filer, of about $420. So if they paid $4,600 right off the bat, or when they file their income taxes, they're getting $400 back. So in some ways you could see that as, well, their property tax liability just became $4,200. And then in addition to that, you have the itemized deduction at the federal level, roughly speaking, might be double Oregon's just based upon our marginal rates. So you'd add another $800 there. So about $1,200 is taken off the property tax bill through the itemized deduction. And it's, I bring that up not only as an example of ways you could work through the income tax system if you wanted to provide relief or change something similar to a circuit breaker, but also a program that's already out there as well. So if you're designing a homestead exemption, this is something probably to keep in mind that's already out there too. And this is
Kyle, if I can interrupt, you could wait, you could double the weight for those deductions, say for the 12,000 through 84,000 range, and say you get, you know, $2 per, you know, double the value as a deduction if you were trying to look at a property tax relief plan for middle class.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's working through a circuit breaker will often work through an income tax system is one way because it's keen off of income. But yeah, there's a number of ways you could do that too. If you want to make sure you're touching on all homeowners, you would do something outside of the deductions, perhaps a credit or a refundable credit or something like that, so you're not just getting those that are itemizing their deductions. But certainly it works as a good example of, here's something in place, here's how it works. It works off of the income you're already filing in your return, and then yeah, you could definitely adjust it as you see fit to make it more or less, however you want to make changes to it. Here's just a listing of property tax expenditures that are supporting housing in some way. Not really going to go through this list. You can see there's education, they're by category, so definitely low income and charitable. There's a few, and it's related to homestead exemptions that we have on the books here in Oregon right now, and it's, we have the Veterans Homestead Exemption for Active Duty Military, and then a more recent one is the First Responder Killed in the Line of Duty. And that's an option for counties to put in place for first responders that are killed, and exempting up to, I think it's $250,000 of assessed value. But that would be dependent upon local governments choosing a program to put in place. And this doesn't include the most recent session. This was actually from a year ago. But it's more to just give you a sense of what's out there right now. And really, there's not a whole lot of broad applies to all homeowners or something of that nature. They really are tailored. Mostly the biggest one there is the veterans one. And the historical property tax relief programs, we have the homeowners and renters refund program and the property tax relief program, the PTR and the HARP. I believe the HARP was discontinued in 91, and then PTR was only around for about 4 years, 79 to 85, so about 6 years, I suppose. And the most recent was the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. That one went away just in the last, I think the last year payments was last fall. And that was absorbed more or less into the housing, other housing programs with the housing agency. So that was just realigned. But these are relief programs that were in place, and certainly they went away, and it coincides in some ways with Measures 5 and 50 also coming into effect. Okay, so the next slides I have, I'm using some census data. So these are the definitions of monthly owner costs, gross rent, and housing costs. But it's just to give some sense of homeowners and renters, how much are they spending on ownership costs or on rent, which would include property taxes as well. They'd be a subset of that overall cost. And the chart here I have on the right is the one I alluded to earlier, and it has the average annual change from 98 to 2016. So again, 98, just starting there, that's post-Measure 50 coming into effect. And you can see different rates of growth in both income and costs. So I wanted to compare that to the maximum assessed value, which is fixed at 3%. And the first one here is the Oregon House Price Index. So that's about 4.4%. So this is a statewide figure, and it's showing, well, on average, your house price index has gone up about 4.4% per year. Of course, there's been years that exceeded that, and others where you've had even negative. But that's 4.4%. MAV is about 3%. So you can see right there, MAV is giving you that 3% limit is helping you out in some ways, or helping out property owners in some ways by fixing the growth going forward. The S&P 500, that would be an example of, I suppose, wealth increases, about 3.9% over that same period. Oregon per capita personal income, 3.1%, so that's tracking in line in many cases with maximum assessed value. And then the Portland-Salem CPI, that would just be inflation. A good example of inflation here in Oregon is a bit below at 2.3%, and then you have the Social Security COLAs, cost of living adjustments, and those have been 2.1% on average over that same period. And again, that keys off of the CPI nationally, which is not surprising that it's more or less in line with the Portland-Salem CPI. But you can see that if you're dependent upon Social Security as your only source of income, you're seeing growth of 2.1%, and you could see growth 3% in your property taxes per year. So I just wanted to highlight some of those differences as well. And then per capita personal income, more or less in line, though, with 3%. So the charts I have up here are about owner-occupied households paying property tax liabilities. This just gives you a sense of what is the average property tax bill here in Oregon. And again, this is coming from census data, so it is self-reported American Community Survey data, but it tracks in line with what we have as well when we look at the property tax statements. About 44% are paying $3,000 or more is what their property tax liability is per year. And you can see the different buckets there to give some sense of what is the average property tax liability. Ownership cost is a percent of household income by age category. There's always been a threshold. A lot of times you see in the literature where they talk about this 30% cutoff, where if you more than 30% of your income is going to maintaining your household costs, then you're often considered in a less affordable bucket. Now, there's definitely, you can debate whether that 30% is a good threshold, but it's just one that's out there, so I stuck with it. And you can see by the different age groups, there are different numbers or different percentage of the households in those age groups that fall under below that 30% or above that 30%. So above that 30%, you might say, well, that means they're under stress to afford their housing. But you can see in the category at the highest is that 15 to 24, but that would be at the head of household is fairly young, and this isn't owner-occupied. And then as the age increases, you see that 30% or more of the costs going to housing go down until you get to that 64 plus when it ticks up a little bit. So that's probably not too surprising that once you get 65 or older, a little bit incomes generally go down for the households. So a little bit more are spending more than that 30% threshold on their household costs. This is keeping with the same idea, only it's by income. And it's, again, it's probably not too surprising that the lower income you are, the more likely you are to be spending more of your income on housing. As you move up the income, categories, you can see less and less are above that 30% threshold. Because as your income goes up, your housing costs will just take up less of that income. And there certainly is a bit of a floor there. And you see that in the gross rent as well, follows that same trend, where the lower income are spending more and more of their income as a percentage on their rental costs. So it gives you some sense, if you were looking at some tax relief keying off of income, gives you some sense of where people are or households are falling today. So potential programs, the committee has heard certainly a bit about the homestead exemption. So that's just allowing, you're providing an exemption based upon, generally it's going to be on value. You can tailor it in a number of ways, but it's primarily going to be for owner-occupied, and then you say, okay, we're going to exempt the first $50,000 of value, $100,000 of value, first 40% of value, something like that is your traditional way of a homestead exemption. Circuit breaker is when something becomes considered a circuit breaker, it's usually that it's keying off of income. So you might provide a homestead exemption type program, but it's keying off of income. So you say, well, what are your property tax costs, how does that relate to your income? If you're above a certain threshold, then you get some sort of relief. And there's different ways to design the program, different thresholds, different buckets you can use, but those are the general different ideas. I'll touch on a little bit more detail on the two. But so the homestead exemption, again, the general structure.
Kyle, excuse me.
Yeah.
Senator Burt-Trigger.
So, Kyle, go back to the last slide, please. On the homestead exemption, though, if you look at the rural counties like Lake and Wheeler and Harney County, you do those homestead exemptions, and the county is going to suffer dramatically because the property values are so low. And so what are the counties going to use to run the county?
Right, Senator, I'll jump back ahead. One of the things with that's definitely been part of the discussion that this committee has had. So one of the goals I had today was to talk about different ways to work around that, if you will. And one way would be you can definitely, instead of using a homestead exemption necessarily, you'd use the relief through the income tax program. That'd be state finance relief, but that'd be one way forward. Another way I was thinking is you could isolate it to just school districts. And that sounds different, but you would, because they have the state school fund, you have that matching dollars, you can backfill. The state school fund automatically backfills in a way. Now, you need to put funding coming more from, say, the general fund to backfill those dollars. But if you provided a homestead exemption just from school districts, you would avoid affecting, say, a county, a city, those local districts. They would still get their full property tax imposed. It would be the K-12 school district that would get less, but that would be taken into account in the school funding formula. And that's.
I don't think the northern part of the state would be too happy with that if the rural schools were getting more money than they were.
How would that look? That would have that effect, wouldn't it?
What?
You'd be essentially subsidizing rural, downstate schools.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It would depend upon how you structure, I suppose, the homestead exemption and who's benefiting from that to begin with. And then it would be, yeah, you are working within the school funding formula system as it is. So the way it's structured today, you do have different districts that have different levels of funding coming from the property tax side of things, and they're getting then more revenues perhaps from the state to get them up to that equalized amount. So that would be inherent in the system. And again, there's from an accounting perspective, there's a lot going on there, but it was more just from a policy concept. There would be ways of, if you exempt, say, 70% of residential value in one county and 30% in the other, there are ways to do that outside of the committee's also heard you could do some revenue sharing and things like that, but that could be rather difficult with all the local taxing districts.
And I think we had an amendment. I don't know if it ever got into SJR 17, but Paul, I think you wrote an amendment to mitigate the thing you're talking about where it would just zero out some of those counties down there. Instead of a $100,000 exemption, it would scale it.
Mr. Chair, we've looked at a number of adjustments. A simple adjustment would be a percentage basis where you take, instead of a fixed dollar amount on the homestead exemption, you take a percentage. So you have that you take care of those price differentials. But you still do have, you're always going to have the issue around the homestead exempt residential property as a percentage of the district's overall, since it's focused just on residential property. So there would have to be some type of a revenue sharing mechanism to deal with that part, even if you use a percentage.
I guess what I'm worried about is I already get a lot of flack about my district not paying enough taxes for law enforcement and stuff like that. If this makes it worse, I'll probably get more flack. If we do corrections and try to correct that, then I'm going to have people in my district who lives in a three-bedroom, two-bath house saying, hey, I only get, you know, $200 a year tax exemption on, but somebody that lives in a three-bedroom, two-bath in Portland are getting a $1,200 one. So then we're going to have that despair going on, too.
So you're just going to have to move.
It's crossed my mind.
Well, and Senator, to that point, it depends upon the overall discussion, I guess, of the tax reform. Because going back to that, the box and whisker plots, the revenue lift, if you move to real market value, would be different in different areas, too. So if your starting point is you're going to get revenue lift by shifting to real market value, that's going to affect different areas of the state vastly different, where others may see an overall average increase of, say, 3 or 4%. Others might see 20%. 25%.
Then I'll be dragging you along to my town hall meetings, and you can explain that to them.
Yeah. So, again, these are all conceptual ideas at this point, of course. But, yeah, I did want to give the sense to the committee that there are ways to mitigate those different effects on different districts, certainly. So again, just I guess I was hitting on some of the differences between a homestead exemption and circuit breakers. Again, circuit breakers, they give a little bit, they're keen off of income generally, so you can, what we see in different states and in the literature as well, is just a lot of times you can have different thresholds. So multiple thresholds is usually the most popular, where you have different buckets, if you will. You can think of it almost like the income tax brackets, where if you have property taxes as a percent of your income is a higher amount, then you would get more relief. And it reduces down as less and less of the property taxes are made up by your income, or even you just hit an income threshold. So you could say if your household's making over $70,000 or something like that, that's just the cutoff. You get no relief. Again, it all depends upon how you structure it, but that's the flexibility of a circuit breaker program compared to a homestead exemption in some cases.
I don't think that's going to go over so well. Why should somebody say, well, I have a good income, so I should pay more property tax than the person next to me that doesn't have a good income? Who has the same value home, that's not going to go over very well either.
No tax goes over well.
No, but I mean, for equity, why should your income have anything to do with your property, with the value, you know?
Okay, I think I've touched on most of this. It's just talking about the homestead and renter credit, and then I guess the incidence of the revenue impact in some cases. So whether or not you wanted to confine that to the property tax system, which would be local taxing districts, and then the state school fund in some ways as a secondary, or using the income tax system as the vehicle to put in some form of relief. Those are kind of two of the primary ways that you could work move forward with it. And I think I was just trying to highlight some of the key policy decisions, but at this point, I think they've pretty much all been discussed. Of course, the first one is just the eligible groups. Looking at other states, you definitely see, do you want it to be homeowners? Do you want to include renters? And then income, age, home longevity, those type of things all come into play in different states and just in policy options that are certainly available. Whether or not you want to make it a homestead exemption or a circuit breaker, there are administrative differences as well, whether or not you want it to work through the property tax system. One of the benefits of a homestead exemption is it's often administered by the county assessors or the tax collector, so when you get your property tax bill is when the property tax relief comes through, whereas if you have a program where you have to apply for it or you work it through the income tax program, the relief doesn't come through at the same time that tax liability does. So you might get your tax bill in November, and then you don't get your relief until you file your taxes the following late winter, early spring. So things to keep in mind. And then there are certainly a lot of options that are available in other states that can be looked at. They cover a broad spectrum of different relief programs, so I didn't really list them here, but there are other ones that could certainly be looked at in more detail if it's an interest to the committee. But that's the discussion I had today, and again, the key takeaways or the goal in some cases of this presentation was just to give the committee some sense that there is quite a bit of flexibility in how you would want to design a program. Of course, it works within the context of what it is you're changing to begin with would probably inform how you'd want to design some sort of relief program.
And adding a layer of difficulty to all of this, Kyle, is that most of those substantive changes that you talked about require statewide vote, because most of them will lift or change or modify Measure 50. Mm-hmm. And
well, Mr. Chair, if you do a state approach, it wouldn't necessarily require constitutional change. For example, if you had developed a revenue source, a statewide revenue source, then a portion of that could be used to fund a circuit breaker, for example.
Or just property tax relief.
Right. Mm-hmm. For property tax relief for seniors or for certain groups.
True, but that doesn't, I think, one goal that, to me anyway, would be a higher priority than that is to fix this inequity mm-hmm. that we have that just is pervasive and growing every year that we neglect it. tail of two houses, mm-hmm. and that's a statewide vote. Mm-hmm. This is so yeah. incredibly complex that it's very, very difficult for an average mm-hmm. homeowner or non-homeowner to make sense out of what we're trying to do.
Mr. Chairman, we've talked about two inequities. One is the kind of the vertical inequity, which is that tail, the low-income tail, where you see that higher effective rate for the residential mm-hmm. property tax. So you could address that with a circuit breaker or some statewide mechanism, but you're right. In order to deal with the horizontal inequities, equals being treated unequally in the system, you need a constitutional change.
Senator Bircher?
Well, it's like everything else we deal with. It's complicated. We have a tendency to pick those issues.
That's what our committee's about.
Yeah, that's
as easy as anybody could do it.
That's where we get the big bucks for.
Any further comments to Kyle or questions?
No. There's just too much.
Okay, Kyle.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Do you want to take a break? You do want to just power through this?
I don't need a break.
Final issue here.
Okay.
Paul, is this your issue?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I mean, we thought the state finance, local finance is pretty easy, so we want to go to the federal government
yes, right.
and get into them. Get into the more difficult
They're
topics.
They're supposed to fix that here by the first
of
the year. We'll see.
Yes. Yes. Well, this is what we've done here is looked at the possibility of a federal change that's being talked about. You know, how do I move this forward? We're trying a new mouse a mouse from the dais approach. Okay. And how do I move it forward?
Or just use your space bar.
Space bar. No, I don't see that. We're not connected with this.
Oh. Right. He's connected with the one down there.
Yeah.
He just wants to scroll.
Oh, okay. Scroll. Okay.
Scrolling.
Okay. Got it. Thanks. Okay. So, one of the things that's been talked about a lot at the federal level, and we talked about it during the session, where Christine and I went through kind of what the president's proposals were, what the Congress had been talking about, and one of the key elements was the notion of elimination of the federal SALT deduction, which is the state and local tax deduction. So the rationale for doing that, and this is the rationale from the federal government standpoint, let's be clear, not from our standpoint as a state at all. All the states would oppose this, and local governments would too. But from the standpoint of the federal government, if I were advising the Senate Finance Committee, for example, one of the things you would look at is that, well, what the states are doing through this SALT deduction is they're exporting their tax to the federal government. The federal government's picking up part of the tab through this deduction, and Chris went through some of that with businesses. But with individuals, through their itemized deductions, they're, in effect, the federal government's picking up a share of that state and local tax. So a state with relatively high taxes, particularly income taxes, property taxes, gets subsidized more by the federal government. So the argument is it's exporting. And as you recall, in our last meeting, we went through and looked at the estate tax, where the feds completely subsidized that for decades through the pickup tax, through the credit. And they took that away, and then the states were on their own, and it's a much different kind of a environment. And so that's a possibility that could happen again with the SALT deduction. The other issue is around the alternative minimum tax. The alternative minimum tax, which is kind of an odd creature, but one of its primary effects is to eliminate the SALT deduction for certain individuals who are subject to it or offset it with the alternative minimum. We'll take a look at that. And then, of course, if the feds are what they've been pushing and talking about is lower rates, both for corporations and individuals, and this would be a mechanism that they could use to offset some of the federal losses, revenue losses. So those are the reasons why we take this possibility seriously, not that it's something we think is a good idea, but it's something that we take seriously. Here's the folks that are using the SALT deductions on our state income taxes. I downloaded this data from Equifax about federal Oregon state tax returns.
That's very impressive.
Right from the horse's mouth, right. But these are actually IRS data from that received from our Department of Revenue for 2015. And you can see the number of filers that have used the SALT deduction. Income taxes, of course, is predominant. Property taxes or real estate taxes, as they're called on the returns. But we even had about 3,500 people that paid Oregon income taxes that used the sales tax deduction. And remember how that works on the federal return is you get to choose. Originally, when the 1986 package was passed, it included only income taxes. Sales taxes were not allowed as a deduction. Now, you can choose between sales taxes and income taxes. So we obviously had some folks, probably some part-year returns in Clark County, residents there that are paying Oregon income taxes that use sales taxes as a deduction on their return. But overall, it's about 674,000. That's about 38% of overall filers, and the amount deducted is about $8.5 billion. Some people in the wrong way. So if you look at how this is distributed among Oregon taxpayers, these are itemizers. So you're going to see the SALT deduction is spread toward the upper middle to higher income groups. So you have people with taxpayers that, for example, over $1 million, it's about 0.5% of the total, 3,500, they're picking up about 10.6% of the SALT deduction. So one of the impacts of eliminating the SALT deduction is to hit upper middle income and higher income individuals. And that's one of the consequences of eliminating that SALT deduction. So the other factor that impacts the SALT deduction is the alternative minimum tax. And the way the alternative minimum tax works is that you tend to fall into that category as your income rises into the 100 or really into the 200 to 500,000 group. So that's about two-thirds of the people that are paying the alternative minimum in Oregon. It's about 59,000 taxpayers, or about 8.5% of the SALT deduction people. About 10% of them have to pay the alternative minimum. From the alternative minimum taxpayer standpoint, the effect of eliminating the SALT deduction, they've already felt that impact largely. So they're somewhat softened by that impact, because they can't deduct use those deductions now under current law where they're offset by the alternative minimum tax. When you get up toward the higher end, you see that you have fewer of the folks at the higher end that are actually using the alternative minimum or affected by it, because they get into the higher rate categories up toward the 39% that Chris was talking about, the top federal marginal rate. Once you get up into that area, then the rates begin to take over more and more, and you get up above the alternative minimum. So that's why you see this kind of odd effect here, that it's these, you know, primarily upper middle income folks that are affected by the minimum. Now, we looked at how the SALT deductions affects different states. State Tax Notes did an article on this, and it got the different states' impacts. Oregon is one of the top 10 states in terms of users of the SALT deduction. So if you look at it as a percentage of our AGI, we're well above the national average. About 7% of our AGI is used as a SALT deduction compared to a national average of 5.3%. So strictly from that Oregon taxpayer standpoint, Oregon will be affected more by this change. But you can see that even a bigger effect is in California. And the reason why California is higher than us is because they have high income taxes too, but they also have more high income individuals that are itemizing and using the SALT deduction. There are other western states I plugged in, and the western states in general tend to not be affected as much because they're not as intense users of the of the income tax, the state income tax, particularly Washington and Nevada, for example. Idaho is a very balanced system, but still you can see most all of folks in Idaho use the income tax, choose the income tax for their deduction rather than the sales tax, even though they do have a sales tax there. In Washington, of course, you have the opposite occurring. You've got 10% who actually use the income tax deduction. Again, these are probably people that are part-year residents in Oregon or that somehow are, have some nexus in Oregon through a business that are paying Oregon income taxes. But then, of course, most Washingtonians who itemize are going to pick the sales tax as their alternative and pay on that. But again, if you look at the percentages of AGI, these states, Washington only 2.9%, Nevada only 2.4%. So they're not as impacted as we are because of their tax structure. So that would be one of the changes right off the bat. If the feds were to go in this direction, is Oregon would be disproportionately hit by that change. The other thing that's kind of interesting about these data is that even though Oregon is a very intense user, as you know, of the income tax and is an intense user of SALT, and they're very highly correlated, the SALT deduction and the AMT, but for Oregon, because of our income distribution, because we don't have as many people in those higher income groups, our use of the AMT is only about equal to the national average. Well, I thought that was kind of interesting. I thought we would be a higher user as a percentage, but we're not. And you can see California, for example, who has a lot more high rollers than we do in terms of income, they're at 4.7% in terms of using the AMT. So even though we're heavy SALT users, we're only average in terms of the offsetting effects of the AMT. So if you look at the reductions in income, again, this is taken from an article in State Tax Notes. It's used. There's a Brookings Institution had a simulation model that looked at the impact by state. This built in, for example, the Pease Amendment that phases out deductions at the federal level. You can see that in terms of the percent reduction in after-tax income, factoring in the AMT offsets, Oregon is about 0.9%, which is a little bit higher than the national average. California is about 1.1%. So our income effects are only slightly above the national average, but our number of taxpayers affected is well above the national average, again, because we have so many SALT users that they're affected by that elimination of the deduction. And you can see the estimated federal tax increase is about $573 million. As a result of the change in Oregon, about 555 nationally. Again, the western states, Washington, Idaho, and Nevada, are not affected nearly as much because of their tax structures. So this would definitely be a change in federal policy that would not have a uniform effect across the states. And Oregon would be one of the states that would be affected more adversely by the change. Now, of course, the other thing to keep in mind is whatever the federal package is, this would not be the sole piece of it. It would be other elements to it. Rate reductions would be a major piece of it, and that would interact with our tax system as well as the SALT deduction. In terms of our reconnect issues, remember we talked about those during the session, we don't allow, you can't deduct your state income tax from your state income tax. So that doesn't affect us, the income tax piece. But the property tax piece does affect us. And you saw the numbers that Kyle had showing that. So that would be a decision for you to make in terms of a reconnect if something like this happened. You would automatically eliminate the SALT deduction for property taxes as part of the rolling reconnect. So you would have to act to reinstate that deduction.
Question, Paul.
Senator Butcher.
You can deduct state income tax, your state income tax from your federal tax, but you cannot deduct your federal tax from your state.
You cannot deduct your federal tax from your state, but you can subtract a part of it.
Right.
So remember that operates. And that's, of course, another thing to look at is the subtraction. The big difference with a subtraction is that you don't have to itemize. You remember you went through that decision with the senior medical where you change that from an itemized deduction to a subtraction, so anybody can take it. So if, for example, one of the possibilities that I see a lot being discussed is this, you know, these kinds of revenue increases are going to be a heavy lift politically, of course, in D.C. So one of the things we may see is just a straight rate reduction, a smaller scale rate reduction. If that were the case, that would simplify your life in terms of connection issues, because rates are not a connection issue, and you'd see some reduction in federal liability, and that would work through the subtraction to generate some additional revenue. Not nearly as much as, for example, eliminating the property tax deduction, but it would still have a positive effect on state revenue through the subtraction. So my conclusions from again, looking at salt elimination, salt deduction in isolation, Oregon is disproportionately affected because of our tax system. And, you know, one of the things that I think is kind of weird is the way that this is worked out in terms of the sales income tax choice. It almost encourages the states to be less diverse in their revenue system, because if you're more diverse, then you can actually export more taxes. So it's a weird incentive for the states. But if indeed we go along these lines, because we're not diversified, because we are highly focused on one predominant state tax, then we're going to be disproportionately affected by the SALT deduction. We have this strong correlation because the AMT eliminates the SALT deduction implicitly through the offsetting alternative minimum. Even though we get that, some of our taxpayers affected that way, it's no more than the national average. And finally, when we've gone through income tax changes, particularly major changes like Measure 66, when we went through that and Chris went through those numbers, we always had a table there where we showed here's the impact on Oregon tax and Oregon taxpayers by income group, and here's the federal offset. And it usually runs anywhere from 15% to 18% or so. So that would go away if the SALT deduction no longer existed. So it would be, you know, a factor you'd have to think about in both in terms of tax increases and tax decreases for income or property taxes. So it would change the equation and you know, not make it the overwhelming factor, but it's significant enough that it'll have a different impact on taxpayers. So that's what I've got.
Okay.
Speculating on federal action is...
Speculating on federal
actions or inactions.
All right, very good, Paul. Thank you. That was informative. In fact, thanks. These presentations do not fall together by accident. So thank you, Paul, Chris, Kyle, and Corrine for your support help. This is a really productive and informative day, wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
We're a little bit ahead of schedule, so unless we have any other business before us, we will adjourn until November. Thank you.